We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 22nd day of March 2011. It's about 26 degrees in Sydney this morning. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio with me this morning we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, everybody.
And we have Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, everyone.
So in today's show, we've got some interesting interviews coming up. We'll be speaking with Tony McLean in a pre-record. Tony is a counsellor, a psychotherapist, coach, workshop presenter, trainer, and works particularly in the area of domestic violence, and is taking a practical approach on how to improve the situation there in with domestic violence in partners. And then we'll be speaking with Dr. Kim Halford, who is the Professor of Clinical Psychology and Director of Clinical Programs at the University of Queensland. And Dr. Halford has produced a paper which involving his study, which is very interesting in that it's really for the first time it's investigated the real situation regarding Australian newlywed couples and the reported violence that occurs in these newlyweds, which is has produced a few surprises. And Dr. Halford also has some recommendations about some positive steps that we can take in this area, so it'll be very interesting to speak to Dr. Halford a little bit later in the program. So before we get on with the interviews, it's been an interesting week in the news. There's been a combined media statement on behalf of a number of organisations, they being the Family Law Reform Association, the Lone Fathers Association, Parents Without Partners, Non-Custodial Parents Party, Fairness in Child Support, and Shared Parenting Council of Australia. And the statement is made in relation to the Family Law Amendment, Family Violence Bill 2010. Now, all these bodies have got together, and they've expressed a number of concerns about the proposed amendments to the Family Law Act, and going beyond concern actually to the dismay of the members and the many thousands who have sought greater equity and justice in parenting orders made under family law. There's been an extremist view that's being presented by the government in order to support this proposed legislation. It goes so far as to have a legal presumption that family violence existed in all cases before the court. So in essence,
that's disgraceful, really, when you look at that
really is shocking for me.
Yeah. In essence, it's going to, if this gets through, it's going to undo all the good work that was done by the Howard Amendments in 2006.
And that legislates the fact that all men are abusers. That's what it says.
Yep, that's right. It's the unspoken recognition. And it is demonstrated by the requirement that the court in every case is required to so-called proactively inquire. That is, invite the parties to make allegations of family violence against each other. And this is additional to the similar obligations put on the party's legal representatives. So there's this obligation to inquire, is there any violence? And then they've broadened the definition of family violence so that it becomes a subjective test, which is impossible to dispute because it's subjective. So that a person claiming family violence will not be restricted to physical or mental abuse, but it will be completely open-ended. It will include any behaviour a partner claims makes them feel threatened, irrespective of whether that behaviour causes harm or to feel unsafe. The fears don't have to be reasonable. They are totally subjective, based only on the complainant's state of mind.
So it's open slather to any woman to basically say whatever she needs to say to get her ex-husband's whole case, his whole hope of ever seeing his children, completely thrown out of court on the basis of whatever she decides to say at that moment.
Well, in the current situation, it is usually the women who make these allegations, but we've got to remember that it applies to everybody, and we shouldn't. In order to make our objections heard on this, I think we've got to make it clear that this applies to everyone that comes before the family court. That the normal legal standard, the reasonable person test, will not apply. And it goes beyond that because, as we know, the Family Court does not have criminal penalties for perjury, despite the false testimony having the potential to create enormous wrongs, injustices and damage. It's on this program and in other places that is why the Family Court has been labelled the liar's castle. And this is only going to further damage the court's reputation. What's more, they're going to remove the friendly parent provisions. Now, these are the ones where the one parent does not do all that they should to ensure contact with the other parent. I've heard it described as the teapot approach, where one party will stand with their hands on the hips when the other parent arrives to collect the child, rather than be seen by their body language and other ways to be encouraging contact. Now, that friendly parent provision is going to be removed. So, all in up, this is going to greatly increase the workload of the court and the other organisations. It's going to increase the time and cost in settling cases. It's going to increase the cost to the taxpayer of operating the Family Court. It just goes on and on. And this is a very, very bad proposed piece of legislation. I can only wonder at the motives behind the promotion of this type of legislation.
Well, it's the matriarchy kicking in. It's obviously feminist. I mean, it's all very well to take a balanced approach and say how it could affect women, but the facts are that it is the majority of people who are disadvantaged by this proposed legislation are going to be fathers.
Mm.
The vast majority. So it is an absolute slash at the rights of fathers, a complete and utter attempt to cut us off at the knees, to take away whatever rights we may have had in court, to totally undermine John Howard's equal shared parental responsibility legislation, and just to, you know, put everything into the hands of the biggest liar, the person who can tell the biggest porkies in court will you know, get what they want, and the other one will be dragged away, which in 95% of cases is going to be the father.
I guess the problem here is that there's lack of objective research. Having had a government that said it was going to be making fact-based decisions, there's no evidence whatsoever of any significant upsurge in actual family violence supported by police and medical records since the introduction of those amendments in 2006. There's no explanation of how an inevitable increase in tensions, legal costs, case time and demands on limited resources will reduce family violence. I mean, it's just setting up more adversarial systems.
Which means more money for lawyers. It's going to become more expensive, so the lawyers are going to get their hands into people's estates, people who are unfortunate enough to go through family breakup with all the other disadvantages that their children will bear. The lawyers are now going to have a direct line into their bank accounts that is going to supercharge the removal of funds out of the family and into the lawyer's pocket.
Yes, and there's no study on the impact of suicide rates. I mean, there are a whole lot of issues here. So for people who'd like some more information the media statement that's come out on behalf of all those organisations, you could go to any of the websites. You could go to www.familylawreform.org.au. You could go to the Shared Parenting Council. Their website is www.spca.org.au. Or you could even go to the non-custodial parents party. The contact is John Flanagan, and their website is www.equalparenting.org.au. So that issue really needs to stay on the boil, and we've got to do our best to stop that going through.
A complete and utter travesty of the ancient concept of justice.
Yep. Now, there's been a fair bit of correspondence recently. There've been articles in the paper, and particularly in the Daily Telegraph, concerning AVOs of recent times. People might be aware that Ray Hadley, well-known shock jock in Sydney, has recently been through a process where a man named Matt John Murdoch, who is described in court as a con man, was able to take out an interim AVO against 2GB radio star Ray Hadley. It was proved that Murdoch had lied. I think they did this by way of phone records when he accused the top-rating radio host of making harassing phone calls over a number of years. But at the end of this process, I presume that Ray Hadley had the best of legal advice. In any event, he spent, wait for it, $110,000 in legal fees to fight the interim AVO granted against him by Matt John Murdoch. It was eventually dismissed, and in dismissing Murdoch's application, Blacktown Local Court Magistrate Roger Brown said his claims were pure fabrication. This is an example where the AVOs have been used improperly. It's good that it's getting a bit of focus now by the fact that Ray Hadley's been involved, and he's been taking the matter up with Greg Smith, who is likely to be the next Attorney General of the state following the election on Saturday. And he says, Greg Smith says that he is familiar with these potential abuses, because let's face it, it's not just in that area where AVOs have been used. It's our particular concern is in the family law area, where oftentimes the person who's accused will agree to accepting an AVO without making any admissions. But the problem then is that that AVO will then be raised against him forever, or him or her, usually him, in any future family law matters. That will be very influential. We can only hope that the Federal Magistrates Court and the Family Court will go a bit behind what's the AVOs, but it's another thing, another burden in going to the Family Court if you have that record of an AVO sitting up against your name. So
it's a very difficult area, because AVOs are useful in situations where there is a genuine threat of violence. But unfortunately, it just seems the criteria for some kind of trumped-up charges which have no basis in reality can get up and can, as you say, limit people's chances for future events. Once you've had an AVO and you've accepted it and you are thereby AVO'd, that stays with you. You have a criminal record of that forever, and that will be brought up, you know, in all future situations of where you have to go to court or any trouble you might find yourself in or anything, really.
Yes, I mean, the AVOs were originally meant to protect people. They're meant to be shields, but unfortunately, some people have found that they can be used as swords, and the widespread use of AVOs is, you'd have to say, is really completely out of control at the moment, when it can be granted just on the unsubstantiated, unsworn testimony of one person about the other. Phil, you got something for us?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Just further on the AVOs and on those reports, in the Daily Telegraph on the 19th of March, Jeanette Fife Yeomans headlines, "Turning AVOs into Weapons," and it goes on to basically cover what you've just covered there, Bill. But it also says quite clearly that there's a couple of district court judges that are come out publicly and talked about the AVOs as well. District Court Judge Paul Conlon says AVOs had become weapons in family court battles for custody. The Office of the Attorney General, John Hastistagos, did not answer emails nor return calls on the subject. District Court Judge Paul Conlon goes on to say on two occasions he can recall the court being advised that the original reason why the AVO was sought against the male was because the female's family lawyers had told her it might look better for her in the family law proceedings when custody was debated. The second district court judge was John Williams, who recently has thrown out two cases of neighbours each appealing against AVO decisions against each other. Judge John Williams goes on to say, regrettably, AVOs are being sought, and even more regrettably, obtained in many circumstances where an order is not justified, thereby bringing the objects and purpose of this piece of incredibly vague legislation into either further disrepute. Judges see it. We've seen it here. We've discussed AVOs and how they're being misused on this program for many years. It's making the mainstream media, being the Daily Telegraph, and there certainly needs to be more debate, public debate, and also within the court industries for this to be seriously looked at and stop this time wasting, you know.
Yeah, it's a huge problem area.
Absolutely. Exactly. You know, and $110,000 to fight a false allegation.
Yeah, that's just unreal. That's completely unreal. And who's got $110,000?
Exactly.
If you are falsely accused, somebody wants to slap an AVO on you because they don't like you or for whatever reason, not many people can come up with that sort of funding to protect themselves.
No, and sure enough, Ray Hadley would have used one of the best solicitors, but even for the average Joe like you and me, you're talking probably $7,000 or $8,000 to actually go into court, spend 2 days in court, one for the actual "No, I'm not guilty, Your Honour," and then they reschedule it for an actual hearing. So you've wasted 2 days of your time, $7,000 or $8,000, a few hours in a solicitor's office explaining why this is frivolous, why it has no evidence based, and you know,
and it costs nothing for whoever, you know, wants to lodge the AVO, whoever wants to accuse you of apprehended violence. I mean, there doesn't have to be violence. There is nothing that has to be proved. It costs them nothing to do it, and it can. And you, if you are the victim of it, innocently, you can be up for thousands of dollars to clear your name to get a fair hearing.
Exactly.
Yes, the problem in Ray Hadley's case was even if he did have costs awarded, the con man Murdoch who made the allegations and got the AVO was unfunded, so he didn't have the funds to pay back the $110,000. So Ray Hadley was left with those legal fees. And just to give a couple of examples of where AVOs have been used improperly, there's been a report of a man, Josh Wells, who'd been riding his horse along the same nature strip for years until a neighbour took out an interim personal AVO against him in January. This was by a woman who complained to police about Josh, who was 18, riding on the council-owned strip of grass, and police suggested it might be better if he rode somewhere else, so Josh agreed. 4 days later, he was served with the interim AVO anyway. The neighbour claimed that Josh had stalked her family numerous times over the past years in his car, revved his engine outside the house, abused her, called her names, The mother of Josh Wells said that they'd lived there for 22 years, had never had any problem with anyone in the street, but the AVO now prevents him from going within 50 metres of the neighbour's home, which meant he had to move his horse to feed it, and this is going back to waste more time in the Port Macquarie local court. Another example was where a pensioner, Ian Booth, was happy to lend a 49-year-old female friend $750 when she said her purse had been stolen. When she failed to repay the money within 3 months, he obtained a judgment, but after receiving the court order, she took out an interim AVO against him, claiming he was stalking her and had made threats, intimidation and harassment. Under the order, he could not go to the Hornsby RSL. Then he discovered he was the seventh person she had been granted an interim order against. Like the other cases, the application against him was dismissed when it got to court, but by then, like Ray Hadley, he'd run up a big legal bill, even denying all those claims. So we can only hope that when Greg Smith...
Plus he lost the money that he'd lent her in the first place.
That's right.
Being a good Samaritan, trying to do a good deed, and that's what you get.
Yep, so we can only hope that when Greg Smith becomes the new Attorney General, he is true to his word and does something about this out-of-control area of the law. On a happier note, I've been reading a blog from Diane, who... makes reference to what's been going on in Japan. Now, we're all very aware of the disaster in Japan, and as our thoughts go out to the people of Japan in the aftermath of this devastating earthquake, we are reminded again about the selfless sacrifices that men make. During the course of the past week and a half, it's not very long ago since it happened, somewhere between 50 and 180 men have donned protective gear and respirators and ventured into one of the nuclear power plants that has been severely damaged by the earthquake and the tsunami, and where there have been at least 3 powerful explosions which have riveted through several of the reactors there. The attempts to bring the rising temperatures in the reactors down by bringing in seawater has not been successful, and the 50 to 180 men who have volunteered to work in the nuclear power plant to resolve matters face sudden death due to the exposure to radiation, which would be equivalent to the radiation one receives as a result of getting 25,000 x-rays at one time. With very little food to eat, They have to work in darkness, illuminated only by torches and flashlights. These brave men toil to save the nuclear power plant, their families, the communities and their country as the world watches with bated breath. The summary, men continue to be the glue that holds our families, our communities and our world together.
And you said that was a positive note, Bill.
Yes, I think I think we sometimes forget that it's oftentimes the men that go out there and do that hard physical work.
Yep.
And they should be, they need to be recognised. Now, just finally, I might mention that there's a fully funded PhD scholarship available at the University of Adelaide, the Freemasons Foundation Centre for Men's Health in the School of Medicine at the University of Adelaide is offering a fully funded PhD scholarship with an annual top-up to investigate health service utilisation in men. So you must be an Australian citizen or have permanent resident status in Australia. You must hold either an honours degree or a master's degree in a health-related field, and you must be able to meet the admission requirements for enrolment in a higher degree by research program at the University of Adelaide. The scholarship is offered for full-time study for 3 years, subject to satisfactory academic progress and at a rate equivalent to an Australian postgraduate award. For more information about the research project and how to apply, please contact Dr. Vanessa Glennon on 08-831-30514. That's area code for Adelaide, 831-30514. Okay, we might go to a music break and we'll be back shortly with our first interview.
Innocent families, lambs to the slaughter. They separate brother and mother and daughter. Ricardo's echo with silent screams. Agony etched in to every ring, a paperwork piled from wall to wall, lost in the horror of Golden Street Hall. Golden Street Hall, where thou fast to crawl, down comes the gavel, the winner takes all. Golden Street Hall, my heart is a pole at the casual carnage behind the creole. Marble, wood panels, horsehair. The symbols of conflict, death, love and despair. Institutionalized horror all day. Haunting sad hearts that can't run away. All for nothing and nothing for all. Life slipped through fingers in Golden Street Hall. A modern torture chamber disguised as a court, processing daily and an endless onslaught of pain and dysfunction, of lies and deceit, while lawyers circle round like spaniels on heat. Nobody knows how far they can fall till they have been to the seventh fall.
grows so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And our next guest is Tony McLean, counsellor, psychotherapist, coach, workshop presenter and trainer based in Mittagong. Tony has an honours science degree, a graduate diploma in counselling psychology, and is a PhD candidate in psychology, counselling for partner abuse at the University of Western Sydney. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
We're doing a time delay here, so it's actually afternoon. But anyway, it'll be put on the show on a Tuesday morning as our usual time.
Right.
Tony, you're the principal counsellor for the Think Twice suite of services, and it's so nice to be able to speak to someone who really is an expert in this area of domestic violence, because there's so much misinformation put out, isn't there?
There is a lot of misinformation. I would hesitate to call myself an expert because it's such a broad field, but you're certainly right, there's a lot of misinformation.
Yes, and it is a broad field, as you said, because I've looked at some of your material, and there's something of a... You've defined unhealthy relationships, healthy relationships, abusive relationships, and I guess there's a mix, sort of a mix and match sometimes in these relationships.
Yes, that's an interesting way to think about it. We could, on the one hand, think of it as a kind of a spectrum, that relationships start with a lot of unskillful or at least some unskillful behaviours, and then they gradually deteriorate. Occasionally we do have relationships where they really are, you know, very problematic and abusive from the start, and they need to be looked at very differently and not treated the same way.
Yes, and it must be very difficult to distill that out, because, I mean, you know, just thinking about different relationships, I can see some aspects where you might say it's the unhealthy kind, some it's the healthy kind, some it's the abusive kind. Do you give a sort of a weighting to each factor?
I guess, rather than talking about a weighting, I guess really what we'd be wanting to look at is what is the impact on the other person, and of course both partners could be the other person, not just necessarily one partner, and what is the motivation behind the behaviour? Is the motivation just frustration, or is the motivation, you know, a real desire to control the other person and how they live their lives and to frighten the other person?
Yes.
Which is often not the case, of course.
Yes, and we hear sometimes about this different type of domestic violence. People want to categorise it as a controlling or a non-controlling, and I think there are a few other definitions. Do you define them in that way?
I do. I think it's very important, because that's where the motivation's coming from, and from the perspective of a counsellor, that has a big impact on how you proceed or even if you proceed. Somebody once said to me, which distilled it down very simply, when you're working with a couple, and especially if there's violence or aggressive behaviour by both partners, and she said to me, the simple question to think about is, who is in charge of the relationship? Sometimes one person obviously is, which may not be the violent person, and sometimes nobody's actually in charge. It's just a mutual poor communication or poor, you know, relationship builds.
Yes, and I guess in people coming to see you, they must have a desire to stay together or to want to do something about it, do they?
We hope so. Occasionally we get people who come along because they want me to help them fix the other partner.
Yes.
And if underneath that they're still genuine, they will eventually come to see what they need to fix about themselves as well. And sometimes people start out thinking they want to save the relationship, but as the process goes along, they may see that this particular pairing, this couple, is not good, and maybe then we have to work to how they're going to separate respectfully.
Yes, and it's interesting because I see you also deal with parents experiencing abuse from adolescent or adult children. Is that something you find is growing?
I believe that it is growing. I can't actually quote you figures on that, but that is certainly my subjective experience, that we are, for a range of reasons, raising children who either they're feeling entitled or they're filling parental gaps that due to a missing parent or due to parents themselves not acting as parents.
Yeah, so well, that's, of course, that is a problem, isn't it, with parents not acting as parents. They want to be best friends with the kids rather than providing guidance and boundaries.
That's right. Sometimes saying no and sticking
yes.
to it. So if young people have the idea that there is nobody setting those boundaries, then they'll step into that gap in the family dynamic and start trying to control parents. This is often mothers, and we think that it's often sons, but I have a suspicion that daughters aren't too much in a minority in that regard. I think that young girls are also stepping into that role in family life.
Mm. And we're particularly interested in the men who have experienced partner abuse. You know, we often hear men are embarrassed to admit this. Do they have that sort of difficulty when they come and see you?
I think that when people come to see me, because I try very hard to start with a completely open mind and I'm really checking out what I'm hearing as objectively as I can, I guess perhaps people respond to that fairly quickly. And so if a man is being abused in a relationship, then he may feel that it is easier to speak up about that. Yeah.
Yes, and certainly it's a lot easier to speak to you than it is to a policeman down at the police station. But I guess sometimes they have to do both. I mean, do you sometimes have to counsel them to go and see the police about these problems?
I've had sometimes had to work really hard to urge men to do that. And I must say in my local area there's a whole range of responses from police officers. Some are quite willing to listen to a man saying that he has been abused by his partner. That may also come about because they have local knowledge, which may not happen in larger city areas.
Mm.
But men certainly do need a lot of urging to go to the police because they may already have had the experience that they haven't been believed, either by the police or anybody else, or because they expect to not be believed, especially if they're big men.
Yes.
They really fear that they're just going to be told to, you know, to man up or keep her in line or what's wrong with her, what's wrong with him because he can't keep her in line. So I think that there's a lot of embarrassment there.
And how does it arise? I mean, my understanding is that people will use what's available to them. But if you get a big man that comes in and says he's been abused by his wife, how would that situation arise? Are weapons used or is it just fists or what?
I think objects that are used as weapons are probably quite often used. So this could be broom handles or could also be throwing objects at male partners. Throwing a glass at the wall beside somebody's head. So, and of course men can do these things too, but I think that these are things that women do. Also in my experience, again, this is subjective, a lot of arguments seem to happen in the kitchen. So saucepans, you know, bowls, that sort of thing can be thrown. And, of course, it doesn't matter whether it's initially a weapon or not, it becomes a weapon and can cause a lot of harm.
Yes, and I mean, it could graduate to things like I've heard of scissors being thrown and all sorts of things at different stages, which then, fortunately we don't have the gun problem in America that they have in America, but I imagine it could easily extend to that if it's available too.
Well, I would imagine that's quite likely. I hope we never get down to that path because when people are very aroused, whether it's male or female partners, they tend to act very much in the moment. You know, we are quite beside ourselves when we're very angry or frustrated or feeling very put down. And so we will just use whatever means we can to try to put an end to that. And if there are dangerous things around, well, that's what we'll use.
Yes, now, we're speaking with Tony McLean, who's a counsellor and psychotherapist and a coach and a workshop presenter from Mittagong. Tony, we've recently had International Women's Day, and I don't know if you're aware of a campaign by Amnesty International out of Belgium.
I saw the website, yes.
Yes, you know, quite extraordinary that the picture I'm looking at, it's all in French, but it shows a man in bed, presumably with his wife, just sitting up reading, and she's reading a book. He's reading what looks like his prison record, and the legend says one woman out of five lives with a criminal. Stop domestic violence. It's I take particular concern or umbrage at this or concern about it because it's presenting a normal situation as though there's something sinister going on.
I quite agree. I was very disturbed by that. A number of things disturbed me. One was simply that kind of representation that it's almost that your partner, your male partner, could actually look just as nice as your average sociopath, but you mustn't trust him. He could be a criminal. Also, simply the figure of one in five, wherever that figure was obtained from, it will almost certainly be a lifetime figure. And yet it gets translated into, well, one in five women today, not over an entire lifetime, even assuming, you know, allowing for that figure to be accurate. So it's a blatant misrepresentation of the statistic. Also linking a European country with, I've forgotten the other country, but I think perhaps it was Algeria.
Nicaragua, I think it was Belgium and
Nicaragua. Yes. Figures for third world countries are going to be completely different, and because of not just partner violence, but because of all of the stresses in those countries that just lead to much greater violence.
Yes.
Right. So it's a complete and utter misrepresentation and I think a very poor use of Amnesty International's money.
Yes, oh, well, I know a few people who have taken the opportunity to withdraw their support and let Amnesty International know, so hopefully it might lead to something with them and correcting that. It's a disgusting advertisement, I think.
I think what's also unfortunate about that is linking that with International Women's Day as well.
Yes.
I think it's a very great pity, whilst obviously as a woman, I think there are still lots more areas where women can be more active and involved and play a major part in society. I just don't see that it's appropriate to link that with domestic violence. To me, they're two only slightly connected issues, but certainly shouldn't be discussed in the same breath.
Yes, and with the supporting material with that poster is you know, they're really gung-ho. They're suggesting that people should get the poster and distribute it, leave it at the reception counter, put it on walls. They've got unlimited finance, apparently, to provide free copies to anyone who wants them.
Yes, I found that disturbing, that their money is being used to do this. We know how great a need there is for Amnesty International around the world in other arenas. But, I was most concerned that they were spending their money producing information like that, which is very misleading, if not blatantly inaccurate.
Yes. Now, Tony, when you're dealing with people in a victim or abusive situation, I think one of your main methods is to develop the compassion in the perhaps the abuser. Is that something you focus on?
It is. The one has to tread very carefully there because even it's very hard to even talk about an abuser and an abused person because so often it's just not that black and white. Victims can be abusers and abusers can be victims. So it's a very sort of fine line. One has to be careful about developing compassion or connecting with that part of an individual when the other partner is still hurting from what's been done. So if both partners are hurting from what they've done to each other, that comes a long way down the path to get to that point.
Yes, and I suppose just thinking about that, it probably goes from generation to generation as well, does it?
It does indeed. We cannot help but take our family experience into our adult relationship. Sometimes we may have learned quite a bit from that before we get there, but often we haven't, and it's not till we're actually confronted with similar situations in our adult relationships that we start to realise how much our, you know, family of origin experience comes to play, how much that bears in the new relationship.
Yes, so I suppose the reason I was raising compassion is just I've recently read a book by Dr. Martha Trout on The Sociopath Next Door, it's called. And she thinks something of approximately 4% of the community are sociopaths, and she refers to that as someone without any conscience or presumably wouldn't have any compassion.
Yes.
Is that, what would you say in Australia, is it anywhere near that level?
Oh, look, I'm not qualified to say with that. In terms of my experience, one of the things that I have done is to run for a number of years or co-facilitated programs for male domestic violence offenders with corrective services. And I would certainly, in terms of the people who've come through those groups, would put the figure at much lower than that, but that's not representative of the whole population. That's just in that particular area of offending behaviour.
But I guess, do you think the sociopath, does that go with being a domestic abuser, do you think?
There will be domestic abusers that we could describe as sociopaths, and they could be either male or female.
Yes. Oh, yes, I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, I don't see that they make up a large population, though. I think the vast majority of people who use violence or aggression in their relationships are people using unskillful behaviours to get their needs met.
I see. And so it develops as a frustration. Is that what leads to it?
I think that's often the case, the frustration and feeling that they're not heard or that they're not respected in the relationship. Also, just simply not having good relationship skills because they didn't observe them in their parents' relationships. So they actually, you know, nowhere do we study relationship 101 to find out how to behave in a way that enhances relationships rather than diminishes them. And it's not until they come along to counselling and basically have some coaching in relationship skills. And that's even when there's not aggression or violence, but just general marital dissatisfaction. And that's very much part of my focus. When people get to that point and they start to see the benefits of that, then we can work more on compassion and help amplify the benefits in developing your relationship skills. Because that requires a bit of sacrifice and effort to do that.
Yes, and I imagine without counselling, people might do exactly the wrong thing. I notice you have a walking on eggshells assessment, and perhaps people do too much walking on eggshells rather than actually confronting the problem.
They do, and then when they go about confronting the problem, they do it in a way that's almost guaranteed to not have a very good outcome, with or without any violent behaviour. But then we can coach people to do that differently. And it makes a big difference once they start putting it into practice.
So is the secret there to be assertive without being frustrated and violent? Is it is it assertiveness type training?
It is. There's an element of that. And certainly assertiveness is important. I find even more than assertiveness is just not ignoring it. Both men and women, I think, can be guilty of that for various reasons of not facing up to it, whether it's just sort of feeling that it's going to take too much time or, oh, it's not so bad really. They don't realise how much it's building up for them until one day they really explode over what seems like a minor thing, but it's just, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. So it's about being aware of how much something's affecting you and actually dealing with it, then dealing with it in an assertive way, not as a victim and not as trying to control the other person, but in a respectful way to, you know, face up to whatever it is and then negotiate a solution. I think a lot of people think that relationships don't take negotiation, but they really do.
Yes, and I suppose to change perhaps years or even a lifetime of reactive behaviour to suddenly now be assertive or to do something positive about that sort of relationship, it must be very traumatic for these people, I guess.
Well, it does take time. I find the couples who are really willing to own, you know, the things that they're doing themselves and who are sort of humble enough to admit that they get some things wrong are the people who have the greatest chance of success. You know, the counsellor can't do it all, but they can't really do a whole lot except guide the process and support people in making and helping them come up with better ways of doing things and encouraging them and giving them more ideas and options. But it doesn't matter how good the counsellor is, the couples have to have a great willingness to change what they're doing and to see the benefits in changing, because there's always sacrifices in making changes to how we've done things.
Yes, yes. Now, Tony, we're speaking with Tony McLean, a counsellor and psychologist and psychotherapist, sorry, and a coach, workshop presenter and trainer. Tony, we're coming up to the state election and we've had a few attempts at getting Greg Smith to commit himself in this area of men being victims of domestic violence, and in particular what's being done about men's refuges and some of the legislation. Are you noticing any change in that area?
Not really. I'd love, dearly love to say yes, but after the most recent ALRC inquiry into you know, family law and the position of men in family law, men as fathers, and the amount of information that the Commission was given with regard to men as victims did not seem to have any impact whatsoever on their recommendations, and I found that most distressing, if for no other reason than if we don't start acknowledging that some, you know, a not insignificant number of partner violence situations involve men as victims, and if we don't start addressing that, we're just going to make the situation worse for those men, for their future relationships, and most importantly for the children. They're the ones I'm really concerned about if we're going to be raising a generation of children who have been whose father's victimisation has not been acknowledged and addressed, and who potentially are with unsatisfactory mothers, then even though this is a small percentage of the population overall, it's just not good. It's letting those children down.
Yes, and it seems to be all around the world. I've spoken to someone in Canada recently and said there are no male shelters over there, and there are none in, well, if there are any in Australia, I'm not aware of them, but there are certainly very few. It must be a worldwide thing that's going to happen one day. Someone's going to wake up and realise we need to do something more in this area.
Well, I think momentum is growing somewhat overseas. The US has a huge number of studies that show that there is a whole range of male victimisation, and instead of getting bogged down in with, you know, how many victims are men and how many victims are women, I think we just have to acknowledge that they are there and become better at identifying them, responding to them, and also making it okay for women to put their hands up and say, look, actually, I'm the one doing this and I need some help.
Yes.
At the moment, it's also unfair against women, because it's got to be, if it's shameful enough for a man to admit that he's doing this, it's got to be even more shameful for a woman, because as women, we're not supposed to be doing this kind of stuff.
Mm.
And I think that's, unfortunately, the women who are going so gung-ho about male perpetrators are actually doing other women a very great disservice.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary. We seem to have this this ideal of women and mothers, which you know, despite the headlines in the paper almost every second day, it doesn't seem to be dented. So we've got a long way to go, I think, before there's that sort of acknowledgement.
We do, and I sort of wanted to get away from, you know, male perpetrators and female perpetrators, and let's just get down to, you know, partner violence perpetrators or child abuse perpetrators, and get away from the gender divide, and let's just look at how can we keep our families safer and happier places.
Yes, and a very worthy aim. How could anyone object to that? So there are a few positive signs. I see in May 2010, the Edith Cowan University put out a report, Intimate Partner Abuse of Men, and recommended that the government raise awareness of violence against men. I'm not sure what's happened since then, but it is now, there is an awareness growing, I think, isn't there?
I'm sorry, I missed that last bit.
Oh, I think there is. Sorry, I'm just saying there is the awareness of this being a community problem, really, a society problem, rather than just a gender problem. I think that is starting to grow.
Look, I hope so. We have got an awful long way to go yet. In fact, that's sort of the basis of my PhD project, is that I want to look at how counsellors, what is their level of awareness and what are their beliefs around domestic violence and what informs them. So where do they get their ideas about domestic violence, and then how do they respond when individuals or couples come to them for counselling? Do they identify it without the couples having to say it? Because often couples won't tell you that there's violence in the relationship. They want the counsellor to kind of get it, or maybe they hope the counsellor never does because they're too embarrassed about it. And I want to know if counsellors are prepared to accept that a man who comes to see them for counselling could just possibly be a genuine victim, or are they, have their attitudes already set for them that, well, if he is a victim, he must have done something, or he's just lying about it, he's not the victim at all. So that's something that I'm very curious about.
Yes, it's an interesting topic. Now, Tony, we're running out of time, but I just wanted to mention you. Your group programs are called Think Twice, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Now, if people want to find out some more about this, where should they go?
Okay, they can go to the website, which is www.thinktwiceprogram.net.
Great. And that'll have all the information and your contact details and everything
That's
about
right.
the programs.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So the website again, just www.thinktwiceprogram, that's one word, and P-R-O-G-R-A-M .net. And that's where you'll get all the information. Well, Tony McLean, thank you very much for coming on the show today. It's very enlightening to talk to you. As I said, to have someone who really has expertise in this field is a pleasant change, and it's been great talking to you.
Thanks very much, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Tony. Thank you.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, and our next guest is Dr. Kim Halford, who is Professor of Clinical Psychology and Director of Clinical Programs at the University of Queensland. Dr. Halford completed his PhD after getting a degree in psychology, he wanted to do his PhD in clinical psychology. And in 1995, he was appointed Professor and Head of School of Applied Psychology at Griffith University, where he worked for 14 years before taking his present position. And he's also a visiting professor at the University of Oregon, Manchester University, University of North Carolina, and the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Dr. Halford, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. I was very worried you were going to say when I got my PhD.
Yes, I do have it here, but I thought for discretion I wouldn't mention that. But you've obviously broad experience in this whole area, and we're very interested in this paper because there's such limited research on aggression and violence in Australian couples, and what led you to rectify the balance there?
Well, it was a concern that there hadn't been a lot of research on interpartner violence in Australia, and what research there had been had tended to rely just on the reports of women, and it was focused just on violence by men towards women. And the research overseas was suggesting that it's important to look not just at men who perpetrate violence, but also at women who perpetrate violence to get a fuller picture.
Yes,
so that's what we want to do.
And why do you think there hasn't been that research in Australia?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's not a huge amount of research broadly into couple relationships in Australia. We're a relatively small country and we have a modest research outcome. I think also there's been some political resistance to really looking at the issue of women's violence, and I think that has shaped the policy of focusing largely on male perpetrated violence. So I wanted to make sure that we looked at violence by both genders, because I don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be hitting anybody else irrespective of the gender.
Absolutely, that's certainly the position we take here. And there were some surprising results, I guess, when you actually when you did do the investigation. I'm just looking here that you found that with newly wed couples that the female violence was in fact more common than the male violence.
Yes, it was. I mean, there's a couple of things about that. We found that about one in five couples, just slightly over that, were reporting at least one episode of violence in the previous 12 months. And this was in couples, we did this survey with couples within a couple of months of them being married. So they're really reporting about primarily the year leading up to when they're getting married and the first few months of being married. And what this highlights is that this violence often starts very early in the relationship. We know from research overseas that this is common, that young couples and couples early in their relationships tend to be more violent than other couples on average. And as you said, we found that there are actually a higher rate of violence perpetrated by the women than the men. Though I should say that the sorts of violence that women and men perpetrate are somewhat different. So if you just look at the frequency, that doesn't give the full picture.
Mm. Yes, I know from criminal law, people tend to use what's available. So a man might use his fists, a woman might use something to throw, or in America they might use a gun. I guess that's the difference.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly see that women are more likely to engage in what might be seen as more minor or less severe sorts of violence, like throwing things, as you said. Though, of course, if you throw a glass or something heavy at someone and you do it in a fit of anger, the chance that you're going to injure someone is certainly there, and so we wouldn't want to trivialise those acts.
Mm.
But because men are bigger physically on average and stronger, they are capable of doing different things to women. So it's much more common for men to engage in acts like choking, holding down, and actually physically beating up. Now, that's not to say that women never do those things, but it's much rarer, and probably that's largely about the difference in physical strength.
Mm. And you often find where there's one partner, it's actually a couple that are both violent, I suppose, and I think that perhaps goes back to even their courtship.
That's right. I mean, we find that the most common pattern overall is this lower-level reciprocal violence. And when we talk about interpartner violence, often people think about the most severe end of the spectrum, where it is more typically men who are perpetrating the violence, and women are more likely to be killed, for example, by a male partner than a man is likely to be killed by a female partner. But at this less severe end, we do find that there tends to be reciprocal violence. And one of the things that our research and the research of others has highlighted is this is a very strong predictor of couples breaking up in the first few years of a committed relationship. That it's a real marker that the couple is unable to negotiate differences successfully. So if a disagreement escalates to the point where someone's hitting, pushing, slapping, shoving, throwing things, then that's quite a strong indicator that the relationship's in serious trouble.
Mm. And that's how you define the less severe violence? It's pushing, slapping, shoving, that sort of interaction?
They're the sorts of things that are by far the most common acts. And what we find with those is that while they're less severe, they are still associated with risk of injury. When people are angry with each other, which is the most common time when this occurs, then they often misjudge the acts that they undertake. You throw something intending to frighten someone and you actually hit them. You slap someone and they move their face and you finish up whacking them across the nose and breaking their nose. These are high-risk behaviours, and once something happens where someone is frightened or injured by these acts, it can really change the emotional nature of a relationship. It's very difficult to have a meaningful long-term relationship with someone who frightens you, who scares you.
And is that less severe violence likely to escalate to what you might describe as severe violence?
It does sometimes, but the research generally suggests that these are somewhat distinctive types of aggression, that the low-level pushing, slapping, shoving rarely escalates to the really full-blown battering that we see in the most severe cases. That really severe violence is a somewhat distinctive type. And some of the research in the US suggests that there are different risk factors for the most severe violence from this less severe violence. Alcohol and drug problems are common across the whole range, but at the more severe end, you often see people who use violence more broadly in their lives, and violence towards their partner is just one example of where they're violent. Whereas for the less severe violence, it tends to be restricted to the couple relationship. So they're not generally violent people.
Now, in the literature where they assess risk factors for male-to-female partner aggression, I understand there are four different categories. I wonder if you could perhaps take us through those.
Sure. Well, people have come up with a number of different types of violence. Probably the best replicated, the most robust finding is there is a difference between what I'll call less severe and more severe violence. At the less severe violence, we find that often the violence occurs in the context of a disagreement between the partners. So it's something that escalates from some sort of argument or disagreement. It's often reciprocal, that both partners are engaging in this low-level pushing, slapping, shoving, and that sometimes alcohol is involved, and that's certainly a risk factor of having a few drinks. At the more severe end, you tend to see higher rates of male-to-female violence and less female-to-male violence. Often there's more psychological and physical intimidation of the female partner there, and the men often have a history of more antisocial behaviour, of being aggressive towards other people, of crime, and drug and alcohol problems are more often severe in that group, so that we see some clear differentiation of those two types. Within the more severe type, some psychologists suggest there's a couple of different types. The really antisocial type, who often is violent towards many people, and what's been described as a somewhat dysphoric or depressed male, who's very anxious about being abandoned in the relationship, scared that his partner's going to leave, and is often morbidly jealous and uses the physical aggression to control his partner. But it does seem that those more severe types are clearly distinguishable from the less severe types.
And it can then be divided up into the different levels of influence. As I understand it, you've got macro system and an exo system, a micro system, and then an ontogenetic system, which a different approach to how this affects the violence in the relationship as well, as I understand.
Yes, that's right. So if you think about it as sort of a hierarchy of different influences, at the bottom end you've got the characteristics of the individual who's perpetrating the violence and the characteristics of the individual who's the victim. And sometimes they're both perpetrators and victims within a relationship. Mm. And so things like how much alcohol they use, if there's a history of depression, their communication skills would be examples of that. At the broader sort of levels of the context, you've got things like the legal context. We know that the availability of getting protection orders, which allow victims of violence to get a legal order to prevent the perpetrator from coming near them, is an important thing that does protect some victims from violence. So that the broader legal context and social context is important. We know that, for example, as women have got greater access to education and have increased their income, their capacity to leave violent relationships has, on average, improved. And that has probably reduced substantially the number of women who are stuck in relationships because they just don't have the economic power to get out. Mm. So those sorts of social contexts are important. And in that sort of middle level, the immediate sort of context that the couple live in make a difference too. We know that couples who are relatively isolated, the violence often gets worse. So, for example, if you've got a couple who live in an area where they have relatively little contact with neighbours and are quite isolated, and someone's perpetrating violence against their partner, and in such circumstances, it's often difficult for the person who's the victim to be able to get out because they feel so cut off. So a degree of social support and connectedness is an important protective factor against domestic violence.
Yes. I heard you mention communication there. It's a very broad topic, but is that a major factor here, that perhaps men get frustrated or women get frustrated at the level of communication, and then that leads to some sort of violence as a way of expressing their frustration?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, what we found in our study was that couples in which one or both partners felt it was difficult to influence their relationship, it was difficult for them to do things that improved the relationship, were more likely to resort to violence. And certainly at the low level of violence, I think that often people's inability to communicate effectively, to discuss issues, and to be listened to effectively by their partner can lead them to feel frustrated. And I don't mean that this justifies violence, but I think that's one of the things that is a risk factor for violence. So one of the things we've found in our other research is that if you look at couples who have the tendency to be aggressive at this less severe level, when you look at them talking about a problem in their relationship, they tend to get more irritated with each other, they don't listen effectively, they struggle to manage conflict effectively. And interestingly, it's often people who've had violence in their family of origin or who've had parental divorce in their family of origin who show these difficulties. And we think that a lot of these intimate skills of communication are learnt in the family of origin. And if you're essentially exposed to aggression when you're growing up and you don't learn better ways of communicating, then often you carry those tendencies to be aggressive into your next relationship. Yes, into your right. Adult relationships.
So that's a worry there. It could be generational as well, that as a way of dealing with with your problems.
Yeah. We know that, for example, men who see their father being violent towards their mother are 3 times more likely to be aggressive towards their own partners when they grow up than men who haven't seen that when they're growing up. So that's it suggests that there's sort of a modelling effect here, that essentially what your father's implicitly teaching you is this is how you handle difficulties in a close relationship. And unless you get exposed to some better options, then you're likely to repeat those errors.
Yes, and I guess that leads on to the positive part of your report and your program, that there are ways of preventing that of at least lessening the risk of couple relationship aggression and violence by introducing a proper program.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've found, and researchers overseas have also found, that the skills of intimacy are relatively easily learned. 5 or 6 sessions of a couple of hours each with your partner, you can learn different ways of communicating, and this does significantly reduce the risk of violence. And I think that's a very encouraging thing. And we found that the people who benefited most from this were people who had experienced divorce in their family of origin or who'd experienced violence in their family of origin. It seemed like they could relatively quickly pick up these skills, and then that translated into them having a much better chance of making their relationship a mutually satisfying one and one that didn't include violence.
Yes. So do they need to learn self-regulation when these situations arise?
That's certainly one of the things that we focus on, is the idea of taking responsibility and working at your relationship, which we call self-regulation. It's essentially the idea that you make your relationship with your partner a priority and you actively think about what you can do to sustain and maintain your relationship. It's sort of interesting that for most of us, the idea that you need to keep training and building your skills in your work makes sense, but people often don't give the same attention to perhaps building your skills and working at your couple relationship. And yet both work and the couple relationship have a profound effect on how our lives go, and I think it is important to put some time and energy and effort into that. For example, if somebody gets offered a job in another town and it's a good financial and career opportunity, if you're in a relationship, it's important to consider the potential implications of relocating for your partner, what they do, and to really think through whether this is in your shared interests to take this job, rather than just to think about it in terms of this is good for me and so therefore, and my career, so therefore it'll be good for us. If it doesn't work out well, then you may not be better off at all.
Yes, and that's not a once-o. That's something that perhaps needs to be revisited regularly. If the decision is made to move, you then need to come back to it and make that extra effort, I imagine.
That's right. I mean, if you do decide that moving is important and you relocate to another town, then it is important to think about the potential impact on you, your partner, and the relationship, and to try and plan for that. We do see people relocating and then finding that it's really pretty isolating for one partner or the other, and that doesn't work terrifically well.
Mm. And it's interesting, you don't seem to distinguish between married couples and cohabiting couples. Are the results similar?
They are. I think there are more similarities and differences. I think that cohabiting couples are, you know, most people form committed relationships in Australia now by starting to live together. But for most of those couples, cohabiting is sort of a transitional arrangement. We know that across 5 years, on average, about 40% of couples who are living together, 45% somewhere in that range, will decide to get married. About 50% will decide to separate, and only about 10% will continue to live together long term. So people tend not to use cohabitation as an alternative to marriage by and large, but rather as a transitional state where they think either this is the relationship for me or it's not. When people are in those early years of cohabitation, one of the potential strains is about the issue of commitment to the relationship. You know, sometimes people move in together because they're spending a bit of time at their partner's place and doesn't make a lot of sense just to rent two places, so they sort of move in together without a clear discussion about, well, what's this mean? Are we functionally similar to a married couple? We're committing to each other long term, or is this just saving the rent and seeing how it goes? And so I think that what we find is that cohabiting couples sometimes struggle around the issue of commitment and whether they're together long term, and there do tend to be higher rates of interpartner violence in cohabiting than married couples, but that's probably about the fact that it is the early stages of their relationship and that's the high risk time.
Which is interesting. It's not what you'd normally expect, is it? When you think that that, you know, love is blooming and everything is sweet in the garden, but actually that's the high risk stage, you're saying.
Well, it's kind of interesting that couples who have this low level of aggression sometimes don't necessarily label that as a problem. So if you ask them about their relationship, they'd say that it's, you know, pretty good and that they're in love and that it's important. But then, yeah, occasionally they do have these spectacular fights. But the thing that we know is that longer term, those sorts of aggressive acts do undermine the relationship. Mm. So they can feel quite good about the relationship generally, and yet still engage in these sorts of acts of violence. Like with our newlywed couples, one in five couples are being aggressive, and yet almost all of them describe their relationship as very happy.
Yes. It's interesting. And now, your study was conducted with 379 newlywed couples in Queensland. Are you getting similar results from overseas studies, say the US?
It's very similar to patterns of findings in the US and some work that's been done in Germany as well. In many of the developed countries, you do see these general patterns that the most common form of interpartner violence is this less severe but still important mutual pushing, slapping, shoving, and that really does undermine relationships. We did another study with couples who were expecting their first child together and found that the rates were even a little higher than that. We found nearly one in three couples there were engaging in pushing, slapping and shoving, and this was across the time that the woman was pregnant with their first child together.
It's just not something you'd expect to find, is it?
It's not, no. I mean, if pushing, slapping and shoving is never a good idea, it's an extremely bad idea when someone's pregnant. Yes. And in the lead-up to the time when they might, you know, one or other parent is going to be holding a young child in their arms, wandering around the household, if they're unable to control their aggression and start pushing, slapping, shoving, that's very dangerous indeed.
Yes. We're speaking with Dr. Kim Halford, Professor of Clinical Psychology and Director of Clinical Programs at the University of Queensland. Kim, if people want to have access to your papers, is there a site they can go to?
Yes, if you come on to the University of Queensland website and just search for my name, we've got those papers directly involved, and we also have a website there called the Couples Research Program, and if people have a look at that, you'll see that there's also the opportunity there to express interest if you wanted to participate in relationship education. Mm-hmm. And the way that we do that, people can do that at home, so it's possible for someone anywhere in Australia to participate in that program.
Well, it's such important work as the divorce rate's ballooning that we focus on this this area of couples, and I know you have this enthusiastic interest in couples and families, which I certainly share, and we do on this program. Dr. Halford, thank you very much for coming on the program. I think we're running out of time. I can hear the music starting in the background, so could I thank you once again on behalf of Dads on the Air for being on the program, and we wish you all the best in your future work.
Well, thank you very much for your interest, Bill. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.
Meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air. For the last time, this 22nd of March 2011. And we'd especially like to thank our guests today, Tony McLean, counsellor, psychotherapist, coach, workshop presenter and trainer, and Dr. Kim Halford, who's Professor of Clinical Psychology and Director of Clinical Programs at the University of Queensland, both with some very interesting aspects on...
domestic violence. Yeah, it's a fascinating subject when you get into it. It is, it involves a lot of other subjects. There's a lot more to it than just somebody being unhappy and lashing out physically. The sociological causes and all that. I mean, once you start looking at it, it is a very, very fascinating subject.
Yeah, so we've covered the theoretical side with the various papers, and the practical side with Tony McLean, who's out there trying to help these people. So an interesting show. We've got another very interesting show coming up next week, and we'll look forward to your company. In the meantime, if you'd like to hear those interviews again or hear the show again, you can go to our website, which is www.dadsontheair.net. And in the meantime, we'll say goodbye from Dads on the Air. This is Bill Cable from Mediate Now.
And Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com. Have a great week, and we'll be back on the same channel at the same time next week.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads.